Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton's show. Here on the Liberty Radio Network, live from noon to 2 Eastern Time. Every weekday. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Which means I interview a lot of leftists. Because they're pretty good on foreign policy, mostly. Or I guess they're most of who's good on foreign policy. That's a bit more accurate way to say it. Today on the show, Martha Mundy, who wrote a piece on Yemen for Counterpunch. Been trying to get her on for a little while here. She'll be on Yemen as laboratory. Why is the West so silent about this savage war? Very good piece for Counterpunch. And then also, John Pfeffer's going to be here. Where the hell is his thing? I thought it was on antiwar.com today, right? Or was that yesterday? Oh, it was on there yesterday. Pfeffer had this thing at Foreign Policy in Focus that we ran. Where the hell is it? I don't know where the hell it is. I'll find it in a minute. It should be on antiwar.com yesterday or today or some kind of time. Pfeffer, here we go. Oh, the Middle East's new Nakba. We're going to be running it tomorrow. That's it. The Middle East's new Nakba ran at FPIF, and we'll be running tomorrow over the weekend at antiwar.com. And it's about the just incredible refugee crisis that, of course, is 100% the fault of George W. Bush and 100% the fault of Barack Obama. I know that adds up to 200%, but it's a matter of quality, not quantity, and so it's okay. Just as long as you're not leaving them out. It's all right. Yeah, America destroyed the Middle East. Absolutely destroyed it. And I don't guess anybody really knows how many people died in it. There was a new study that came out last spring, I guess, or early last summer, this summer. I don't know, man. They had like 80-something thousand killed in Pakistan. And I know that there have been, you know, on and off again attacks on the Swat Valley and that kind of thing, but, and maybe I'm just ignorant. Maybe there's been a huge, intense, low-level, medium-level war going on this whole time or something, but I don't think so. So how in the hell do you get to 80,000 dead Pakistanis? So that made me skeptical of that whole study. I don't get it. Unless we're just throwing in everybody who died in a flood or whatever, but then what the hell are we even talking about anymore? The last numbers that I really, you know, think there's good reason to trust and believe in about Iraq had 1 million dead. That was Opinion Business Research back in 2007 and 2008. They did the study twice to make sure. And they didn't even go to the most hard-hit places like Fallujah and Ramadi where there was no security, but where the most casualties had been. But they compared the excess deaths from before the war, which is still under the era of UN blockade. But they compared the death rate from before the war to after and calculated that 1 million people had died who otherwise would not have. So that means in battle, but it also means because they died at the checkpoint because they couldn't, you know, on the way to the hospital that they never could get to in time just because of the situation. People dying of cholera and, you know, other diseases they never would have gotten or would be easy to treat in other circumstances, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so back at the time of, say, 2007, 2008, estimates were that there were approximately 4.5 or 5 million Iraqi refugees, about half of them internally displaced, about half of them at refugee camps in Syria and Jordan. Now, some of them tried to come home after the war in Syria broke out, but then, of course, the war in Syria bled back across the border into Iraq, and so talk about caught between a rock and a hard place. The Nakba is right, man. You know, I really like John Pfeffer, too. He's really smart, and he's got, obviously knows a lot of history, so he does really good with explaining the parallels and what it all means. Very important article. The Middle East's new Nakba. You can find it at fpif.org. And anyway, he'll be on the show later on. Last night, I did the Future Freedom Show with Jacob Hornberger. If you want to hear some good revisionist history of the first Cold War, now that we're well on our way into the second. Oh yeah, chat room's making a very important point. I gotta talk about that right now. Just go to liberty.me or just go to my blog, The Stress Blog, and you can watch that episode of The Future of Freedom. Jacob Hornberger, really good on the fake Soviet menace. And yeah, man, so you know what? Wow. So this thing Patreon that I had signed up for, and a handful of you guys had signed up for, they got hacked. Thanks, Kit, for reminding me to talk about that, and it is important to cover. I guess your and my information is all on the internet now. I got an email from them yesterday. I don't know if every patron did. Let me see if I can find it here. They said, well, you don't even need to worry about it, but you could change your password anyway if you want. So I did that. What they claimed in here was, we do not store full credit card numbers on our servers, and no credit card numbers were compromised. Although access to all social security numbers and tax form information remains safely encrypted and all passwords securely hashed, no specific action is required of you, but you could just update your password. That's what they said. But then here's ZDNet, thanks to Kit in the chat room. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. They've posted it all online. They don't have a link to it here. I guess you got to go to the Pirate Bay to download it all. So I guess I need to do that and then search for my name in there, search for my email address and whatever. You know, I don't know. They claim that you're not going to have a problem with your credit cards. Reiterated here. But anyway, if you're one of the few who... I don't mean to sound like I'm complaining. If you're one of the very generous, wonderful people who have signed up to Patreon in order to donate on a per-interview basis to this show, sorry, and you better double-check. Make sure you've got an email from them or that you get in contact with them. Supporters' identities and messages are public. So I guess this was, that's what they're saying is the big scandal here, is some of these patrons wanted to be anonymous patrons operating under pseudonyms. And so now it could be bad for their business or bad for, you know, whatever other problems they got. If it, you know, turns out that they've been supporting this or that artist, I don't know. I know I'm not an artist, but that's really what it's for, Patreon. Anyway, so make that what you will. Cancel your subscription if you must. Do what you gotta do. First things first and all that, you know. Alright, I guess when we get back, obviously we got lots of serious stuff to cover. There's another mass shooting and a big new push for gun control laws And I got Israel-Palestine news here somewhere. Afghanistan. Oh, man. Domestic police state stuff. It's the Scott Horton Show. Stay tuned. Hey, y'all. Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Yeah, sorry, I guess I shouldn't be yawning and stretching on the radio, but, yeah. I'm giving a speech on the 10th, which means not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, in Fort Worth, Texas, at Texas Christian University. The event is called Make Conversation, Not War, a Summit on Foreign Policy. The Texas Millennial Institute are the ones putting it on. They're a group of young Ron Paulian libertarian types. It's Angela Keaton, Jacob Hornberger, Ted Galen Carpenter, and myself giving speeches. So that's pretty great, right? I get to ride some pretty fancy coattails there, man. So, there you go. The Texas Millennial Institute. It's at texasmillennialinstitute.org. It's free to attend, except for the expense of getting to Fort Worth from wherever you are. But other than that, it's free. So, geez, I guess especially if you live in Fort Worth or any of the 20 cities that make up Dallas, then come on out, man. I'll see you there. And in fact, I'm thinking as long as I'm up there, what time is this thing again? Because I might try to go to Overground and skate some vert after this. Except, I don't know, man. I grew up skating 11-foot vert ramps. 14-foot vert ramps are pretty intimidating for this old man. And that's what they got there at Overground. It's huge. I mean, I ain't afraid to drop in on it, do a little grind or something, but man. Anyway, sorry I'm off on a tangent, but my brain very much equates Dallas with skateboarding for very good reasons. But anyway, Texas Millennial Institute. Holding a big foreign policy libertarian thingamajig at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. Me, Ted Kalen Carpenter, Jacob Hornberger, and Angela Keaton. Okay? So, cool. Sorry for going on and on about that, but now you know. I mentioned earlier I did the FFF show with Jacob Hornberger last night about the Cold War. You can find that YouTube at liberty.me, and you can also find it at my blog, scotthorton.org/stress, and the YouTube is right there. Also got a great room in the chat room today. Hey, everybody. How's things? Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. All right, now guns and mass killings and things like this. You know, the mass killing things. You can understand why people are upset and want somebody to do something so that this is not a problem. They kind of got a point. It's not a problem in most countries in the world where some crank can just take a handgun into a school or some other place and does regularly just start waxing people. You imagine, you know, anybody that you care about being stuck in that situation and massacred like that. Nobody wants that. So, somebody must do something, but the question is who and what and to whom. And, you know, the president said in his speech yesterday that, hey, listen, you know, there are common sense things that we can do to prevent things like this. And then he went on to cite Australia and Britain, where they have almost total gun bans. In Australia, they confiscated all the firearms in the country, basically. So, what the hell is he talking about? And never mind, he doesn't want to do that. He knows he can't do that. There would be a war. Try to outlaw rifles and pistols in America, there would be a war. And guess what? the gun-owning civilians would win it. There are 150 million Americans who own firearms. There's only 1 million men in the army, okay? And that's kind of the whole thing about the Second Amendment. I mean, it is for self-protection from crime and that kind of thing, if that's what you want. But the guns are. It's a natural right of self-defense. But the reason it's really in the Second Amendment is so that you'll never need it. The government would never try to take your guns because then you'd use your guns. And you don't need to use your guns unless they ever try to come and take your guns. That's the line. That's the law, according to the charter that allowed the U.S. government to come into existence in the first place. They're forbidden from taking them. That's it. Well, that's just one part of it. And then the other thing is, you know, all indications are this guy got at least 2 out of 3 of his guns legally. I believe every state in the union has a background check of some kind or another. Or there's still the federal one, right? And state law is implementing it. And so, but the thing of it is somebody can be a law-abiding citizen and buy a gun and jump through every hoop and pay every legal tax and get a license and have never committed a crime in their life until the day that they go to community college and massacre a bunch of people. So how are gun laws, how are any gun control laws going to prevent that? Nobody seems to know. And of course, on the left, people, I mean, they're so frustrated about this gun violence, again, which is understandable, but they don't really look at the consequences of gun control laws, and they don't allow themselves to be frustrated by the way that gun control laws are implemented. Gun control laws means punishing people for mere possession of firearms without jumping through all the proper hoops and taxes. But that's not necessarily a criminal thing, is it? Except when it's against the law. Gun prohibition. And of course, who gets prosecuted? That's right. Ethnic minorities and poor people. Oftentimes, in, you know, I'm repeating myself. Because they don't have any political power. And when the prosecutor lays down 10 charges, they just pile them on and on and on. No fair trial for you. You're going to have to plead. And they can give you decades in prison. Decades in prison. Just for having a gun that you're, quote, not supposed to have. Not even for necessarily committing a crime with it. And liberals just don't want to think about that. They don't want to think about that. They're picturing a bunch of big, beer-bellied, white-haired, rich, white Republican conservatives and their guns. And they hate people like that, and they'd like to see the government take away guns from people like that. Except those aren't the people committing the crimes anyway. And those aren't the people who the law subjects to their gun control statutes and put away your cognitive dissonance about your silly little emotional beliefs and think about the real world that you live in. There is an innocent black man being arrested on gun possession charges right this instant. Understand? The real solution, it seems like, is you need to find the loners and losers in your neighborhood and befriend them. Because these guys are getting the idea now that the solution to not having friends is just massacring a bunch of strangers. Maybe they'd be better if you just invite them over for a barbecue one time or something. Smoke a joint instead of taking a Prozac.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here live on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the weekdays. Check me out Sunday mornings on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA. And my archives are at scotthorton.org. Sign up for the podcast feeds there if you like. Our first guest today is Martha Mundy. She is an anthropologist who worked in North Yemen from 1973 to 77. Her book, Domestic Government, Kinship, Community, and Politics in North Yemen, 1995, is a contemporary classic, reads her Counterpunch bio. She is now working on the political economy of food in Yemen, which is going to be my first question other than, hi, how are you today? Martha, welcome to the show.
Hello, I'm fine. Delighted to be on your program.
Very happy to have you here. Now, I won't ask you to rehearse everything about who's who in this fight. This audience is pretty well versed on it, and anybody who missed it can go back and hear a really great summary with Jason Ditz on the show last week. So great. I don't want to waste too much of the interview just on the basic breakdown, because I think pretty much everybody's caught up on that. But my first question, the most important question, I want to get right to. It's about the political economy of food in Yemen. We've heard it reported that the Yemenis, as a nation, import between 80 and 90% of their food from outside. And we know they've been under full blockade for half a year straight now. And while the war is going on, of course, that means that all the local distribution channels are disrupted. Gasoline is either prohibitively expensive or completely unavailable for trucks to bring food to market and these kinds of things. And yet we hear so little coverage of how many people are actually starving to death when it must be thousands and thousands and thousands by now.
Well, it's very difficult to know, even though I have a very close colleague working on the ground with one of the major organizations. It's very difficult to know the full picture. Organizations such as Oxfam, which has long been involved, and Médecins Sans Frontières, but particularly Oxfam, in the very early part of this war, produced an important statement condemning the blockade. People who are very, there was a major letter in the Times of London a couple of months ago, and they were trying to get a second letter in that was diplomats and aid people simply calling for relief to the fuel and food embargo. But none of these voices have been listened to at all. And I gather that some food now is coming in from the south, but into the north somehow. But people are suffering at a level that is simply unimaginable. But the actual documentation of that is lacking, is very poor. And people such as my colleague who's working with an organization in Yemen, but he's not empowered to be producing reports about that. We also know that such aid as is getting through, even through the UN agencies, is being subject to a veto by the Saudis, which is incredible. It's against the UN Charter. But I can't actually answer your question as to how, because we don't have from the outside, nor even from the inside, I would imagine, because that requires a coverage over the whole country that will be lacking.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the only solution is the war and the blockade must end, because if it's just a matter of UN or Red Cross or some kind of food aid coming into Aden, that's never going to make it to the population in the north. Maybe the Houthi army might get some of it, but that's not going to make it to the people who need it the most.
Yes, I mean, I entirely agree. And the World Food Program, which is, of course, one of the big suppliers of food aid, and is itself subject to, I mean, after they destroyed the port of Hodeidah, and they have also bombed systematically food convoys going up to Taiz, trying to go up to Sana'a, and at present, in classic fashion, over the last 2 weeks, they took out all the bridges on the road between Hodeidah and Sana'a. So trying, even if you had petrol, even if you had trucks, and of course the truckers are scared after the amount of shelling of them, that it would be very physically difficult to move food up to Sana'a.
All right, now in terms of the battle on the ground, are the Saudi and allied forces within any kind of reasonable range of actually taking the capital city and driving the Houthis back into the north, or you know, as far as the status quo, assuming there are no real talks or negotiations and things continue as they are, does that look like it's attainable and within any kind of period of time that you could predict?
Well, there are two things to bear in mind. One, aerial bombardment, which is the main, I mean, yes, there are ground forces now in Mareb, right? But aerial bombardment has been the key signature of this war. And clearly, somehow, the Saudis and the Emiratis were at first persuaded that that was going to miraculously, you know, turn the war around, whereas it doesn't. I mean, it destroys the country, it harms the people, but it never can deal with movement on the ground, really, by organized forces. It's important to remember that most of the Yemeni army went over to the Houthis, the Houthi militias, which are the military arm of a political movement called Ansar Allah, are integrated now at present into the Yemeni army. Of course, according to the manner in which Saudi Arabia speaks of it, it's not the Yemeni army, but it still is the bulk of the former Yemeni army into which the Houthi militias, who themselves, after six wars with the central authority, then the last one in 2009 was also involved with also against the Saudis, are themselves a highly trained military. In short, they're not all that different from an army. And they are presently integrated with the Yemeni army. Now, given that, in a sense, you know, half the world or most of the world is pitched against them, I presume that eventually, that if this madness goes on, that the coalition, which is heavily backed, I mean, the United States, that is said by the Washington Post and similar, you know, distinguished newspapers, not the opposition, so to speak, that the U.S. is refueling the Saudi and Emirati planes in the air. There's clearly a unified operations room in Saudi Arabia and in the Emirates in which the Americans and other powers are heavily involved, because you can't refuel a plane in midair without knowing where they are, right?
Of course, yeah. Well, and the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times have both also, again, prominent publications, not the opposition, as you say, have reported that the U.S. is actually helping to pick the targets and basically coordinate the entire war as well.
Yes. And so I think that one of the reasons we hear so little about it, one of the reasons that, for example, it took months and months and months for the BBC to have, as it finally had on Newsnight, some serious coverage from the areas that are under bombardment, is exactly the deep engagement of the French, the British, and the Americans in this whole operation. And that's why it is very, very silent. And the latest proof of that is what happened just this week in the UN Human Rights Council.
Yeah, now, I'm sorry, hold it right there. That's a great place to pick up this argument, this discussion on the other side of this break, the United Nations and what didn't happen this week. We're talking with Martha Mundy. She's got this very important piece at Counterpunch. Please go read it. Yemen as Laboratory. Why is the West so silent about this savage war? We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Talking about the most important story that no one else will talk about for whatever reason, I don't know. With Martha Mundy, she is Professor Emeritus. I did not give her a proper introduction here. Professor Emeritus in Anthropology at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and author of this very important piece at Counterpunch, Yemen as Laboratory, Why is the West So Silent About This Savage War? And we're going to get back to that media silence in a second. But, I'm going to ask you here, Martha. I don't know if there's any way for you to tell, but I'm getting a crackling on your line. Sounds like you have a loose wire on your microphone. Maybe it's not quite plugged in all the way or some kind of thing. I can't see it, but get a little bit of crackle on there. So if there's any way you could tighten up your connections, that would probably help. We'll be able to make do. It's not a deal killer either way. So
I can try. Just a second.
Sure. Yeah. And yeah, I'm sorry. We should have taken care of this during the break, but I was reading. Okay. So the headline at antiwar.com today is UN to let Saudis investigate themselves on Yemen war crimes. Saudi objections kill resolution calling for international probe. And I think that's what you were about to let us in on here when we had to go out to break there, Martha.
Thank you so much. I can't improve the line, but we'll carry on. What is so, in fact, that is one of the reasons I pulled together things to write the piece. What is so extraordinary about this war is the degree to which the normal condemnations of the war crimes that are going on, that is, destruction of historical sites, use of food and fuel as tools in war, the bombing of unit, educational, religious, medical, etc.
I'm sorry, Martha. I'm so sorry to interrupt, but actually your microphone has really gotten worse here. I'm afraid it's going to make the interview unlistenable. Would it be okay if I tried to call you on the number on the London School of Economics website here?
No.
Your CV page there? Or could you put a good phone number into the Skype chat and I could call you back?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So everybody hang tight. It's better to lose a little bit of time on the interview and take care of the audio problem. So I'm going to play a little bit of audio for you here while I get Martha on the telephone. And then that way we can carry on this interview because it's such important subject matter. I'd hate to have it ruined by the audio quality here. So, I'll take it easy on you. It's Friday. Here's a little bit of George Carlin.
We'll take a look at the news hostility scoreboard. Find out how we're treating each other around the world. According to the scoreboard, we got 4 civil wars going on right now. 2 brush fire wars, 4 vest pocket wars, 9 wars of liberation, 2 police actions, 16 revolutions, 35 rebellions, 58 border clashes, 21 terrorist bombings, 36 retaliatory raids, 400 guerrilla operations, 95 commando strikes, 612 acts of sabotage, 237 ceasefire violations, 44 surprise attacks, 6 outside aggressions, 6 internal upheavals, 3 protective reaction strikes, 10 counterinsurgencies, 21 violent disturbances, 30 warlike acts, 906 hostile incidents, 10 arms races, 18 deliberate provocations, 61 threats to security, 9 dangerous escalations, 2 military confrontations, 6 heightenings of tension, 14 heated exchanges, 12 belligerent moves, 17 reprisals, 3 powder kegs, 2 tinderboxes, and an ultimatum.
Well, the Oriental doesn't put the same high price on life as does the Westerner. Life is plentiful, life is cheap in the Orient. And as the philosophy of the Orient expresses it, life is not important.
How many fingers am I holding up this?
Four.
And if the party says there are not four, but five, then how many?
Five.
All right, I'm sorry, guys. Here, I got to find something longer to play. All right, here's a little bit of William Jennings Bryan.
I
just know it's long.
I can conceive of a national destiny which meets the responsibilities of today and measures up to the possibilities of tomorrow. Behold a republic resting securely upon the mountain of eternal truth. A republic applying in practice and proclaiming to the world the self-evident proposition that all men are created equal, that they're endowed with inalienable rights, that governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Behold a republic in which civil and religious liberty stimulate all to earnest endeavor, and in which the law restrains every hand uplifted for a neighbor's injury. A republic in which every citizen is a sovereign, but in which no one cares to wear a crown. Behold a republic standing erect while empires all around are bowed beneath the weight of their own armaments. A republic whose flag is love, while other flags are only fears. Behold a republic increasing in population, in wealth, in strength, and in influence, solving the problems of civilization and hastening the coming of a universal brotherhood. A republic which shakes thrones and dissolves aristocracies by its silent example and gives light and
inspiration. All right, there's some ancient William Jennings Bryan for you. Sorry about that, everybody, but we got Martha Mundy back on the line here, professor emeritus at the London School of Economics, teaches anthropology, and wrote this very important article about Yemen for counterpunch.org. Yemen as laboratory. Why is the West so silent about this savage war? Where we left off, it was Saudi, American abetted Saudi war crimes and the United Nations. Please go ahead.
Yes. Just a moment. I better turn off this. What is this extraordinary is the manner in which, first of all, the United Kingdom traded with Saudi Arabia so that they both get on the UN Human Rights Council. And after the Dutch finally, and the Dutch have been very big in aid to Yemen, by the way, finally put something before the council, and on the basis of a report by Prince Raad al-Husseini, who himself, of course, hails from the Hashemite kingdom, which is a party in this war, by the way, but he acted very professionally and produced a report on some of the alleged war crimes. After both the Dutch and the report to that council, they have managed to get it withdrawn, and a Saudi completely watered-down internal investigation of the war crimes is all that was agreed in Geneva, was it a day or two ago. This is just as usual, but the problem with doing something like that is that ultimately you are destroying any reference. I mean, you cannot, any legal reference that is to govern wars. This could next happen in a nuclear war. This could happen in any kind of war, and there would be absolutely no legal reference. So because it's Yemen and because everybody has gone in there, they seem to be happy to allow this to go on. But the problem of legal orders is that they are precedents. And not to call anyone on this. That's how you can get Prince Raad of, you know, of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan actually producing a report is because he is in his capacity as head of that council representing a legal tradition. And this is to treat law as absolutely nothing. Now, we know all wars violate, but in this very systematic, internationally protected manner, this may be a first. because every time Israel does it in Gaza, the world starts shouting, and correctly so. Whereas in this, nobody's shouting practically, except for the Yemenis themselves, who tried to shout in the early part of this conflict by producing reports, human rights structured reports from the human rights agencies inside Yemen that all exist on a website called, what is it called, YemenSpring2005.wordpress.com. You can find all these reports that somebody put up.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you attribute that silence to? I mean, obviously, Christian Amanpour, we know that she just says what the State Department wants her to say, et cetera. But you're referring to the European governments and the NGOs and the whole, you know, left liberal civil society of Europe, I think.
Well, as I said in the earlier part of the interview, Human Rights Watch did produce some things. Amnesty finally has produced a big report. But it was striking that there must have been pressure on Amnesty, because an earlier piece by actually one of their major people on the Middle East who had been down in Yemen was not published by them. It was published independently by her in a website. And that also I took as a sign that Amnesty itself must have been under pressure. More recently, as part of the build-up to what went on in Geneva this week, Amnesty finally did produce a major report, but we're talking about 6 months into the war. Human Rights Watch was very concerned, produced something early, but then very little thereafter. And those are the two big international names. So the level of pressure, and also the level of pressure on the Dutch, must be really quite ferocious, is all I can assume, because you have professionals who have been trying to do work and then suddenly going silent or coming online, as with Amnesty, 6 months into the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so,
I think that there are material, as I set out in the Counterpunch article, I think there are big geopolitical attempts to plan for something quite amazing that strikes me as, on the ground, relatively unrealistic. But I set that all out in the latter part of the Counterpunch article, and so I think it's probably better said there. But that there was for planning that this was to lead to Saudi Arabia taking control of important quantities of oil, building links with, having the peace with Israel, all kinds of things that are really quite amazing, but which have been said by Saudi spokesmen. And just again, last week, Prince Turkey Faisal was meeting with someone more, Yair Lapid, in New York as part of the UN meetings. In short, somehow this whole thing has been bundled into a much wider geopolitical, fantasy almost, or aim. But I suspect partly fantasy, that the Saudis are to be, and the Emiratis, signed up to. And in the Counterpunch article, the web links were stripped out, but I, of course, have all the web links, to the Al-Nur stuff, the transcript that I cite in the later part is on the website of the Council on Foreign Relations when former General Esky spoke last June. So this stuff is increasingly in the public domain, but you really have to look for it. The reason that people were interested in the Counterpunch article is I put it together. That's right. But you can trace stuff, and I'm happy to supply the web links for anyone who wants them.
Yeah. Well, it is a very good article, and again, it stands almost alone, and that is why it's so valuable, is because there's so little coverage, and especially with real context, the way that you provide it. But if I could just ask you one more thing, to go back to your point before about how the Houthi movement, they've been attacked and survived and gotten stronger, They've been attacked over and over again, and they are a real army. They're not just some militia. They're a real army of their own, and they're now allied with at least huge portions. I think you even say the majority of the actual, you know, quote unquote professional army of Yemen, and including the former dictator Saleh, who used to attack them all the time, is now allied with them. And so this is, I think, what you mean by fantasy, is that these guys have, these daydreams about how this is all supposed to work out, but them and what army? All they're doing is bombing from the air, and you can't defeat them from the air, and whatever, you know, ground forces you referred earlier to the small size of what UAE has put on the ground there, seems like this is going to be a long, hard slog if they just keep going the way they're going now.
Well, I do think so, and the Ansar Allah, which is the political wing, and I want to emphasize that the media coverage in the West always talks about just the Houthis and Saleh as though these were two militia groups. Now, the important point is that these are both the General Congress Party. I mean, Ali Abdullah Saleh is no longer alone, okay, and never. The General Congress Party, which is his party, and the Ansar Allah political movement are desperately trying to negotiate a settlement, whereas it is the coalition and the Saudis who refuse to deal. There is no reason logically that you have to, produce another series of spectacularly large massacres and continue the starvation and destruction of Yemen in the present form, as opposed to politically negotiate. Over a year ago, under UN auspices, on Ben Ammar, you had an agreement called the Peace and National Participation Agreement, which was overseen by the UN. But it was not to the pleasure of the Saudis and their friends. And so, essentially, the government was encouraged to run away, and Hadi and Baha and so forth, and then it became the call for legitimacy. But what form of legitimacy can you have if you don't have political negotiations that brings in all the different parties of Yemen? That's where this problem started. That's why the Ansar Allah were unhappy that they weren't in the original transition discussions properly. And similarly, the southern separatist so-called Hirak movement. Okay, mm-hmm. So, I mean, to my mind, we should absolutely, as progressive people, not be talking about, when can they take Sana'a. We should be talking about why will our governments not support political negotiations to end this crisis in the interest of everyone. It won't be easy, but are you telling me that the further destruction and taking Sana'a by force will be easy? What you just said is indeed it won't be, right? It will be right. Extremely bloody.
And again, back to the beginning here, the poorest country in the whole region, and which imports all their food. And so, I mean, this is like the worst crisis on earth.
With colleagues, I've published two analyses of the problem of internationally led agricultural policy in Yemen, which is, I'm not saying that the population growth wouldn't have meant they needed to import some of their food, but the entire policy that led to the destruction of dry land, Yemeni agriculture, was something that the international organizations, I actually took a stand against part of this stuff in the 1980s, led by the World Bank and the international, the kind of stuff you hear about for other parts of the world. So I have published on that problem. But in the immediate, clearly food is needed. Clearly, it is illegal under international humanitarian law that that kind of blockade that we, i.e., our governments, are supporting is in effect. It needs to come in, and the entire policy for food production needs to be reworked. But it's not going to be simply by reinstalling the same governments without political negotiation, without bringing in those who are fighting the coalition at present, that you're going to get a rethinking of even agrarian policy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Washington, D.C., they're not even dealing with reality at all. They're fighting a propaganda point, where they're pretending that the Houthis are just, you know, basically Hezbollah or something backed by Iran, and that they're fighting the Iranian Empire, expanding through the region and this and that kind of thing. So don't expect any reason there.
Iran wasn't even happy when the Houthis walked into Sana'a. Iran, at a certain level, there is sympathy. But the notion that Iran is in there in the same manner that it is in supplying arms for Hezbollah or training and so forth, it's fantasy. I mean, it really is fantasy. But Iran, you know, the Houthis have made very clear they have been protecting Bab el-Mandeb. They never threatened the shipping there. It's real political dream to have absolute control. But this takes us to the wider problem as to whether, you know, the elites in Washington really care, or are they actually making money on arms sales and control of the dollar and oil, mm-hmm. so that they don't care at all if it's complete chaos from Syria to Yemen to Iraq to the entire region. Mm-hmm. I mean, I leave that to your listeners, because the European elite should care, because a lot of this is really on their doorstep, as the refugee crisis from Syria and the region shows.
Right. Yeah, you would think that they could understand that. I mean, what they say around here is
By the way, I'm an American citizen, you know, and I'm a British citizen. Mm-hmm. So, except we don't have citizenship in Britain, I'm a British subject. But I'm an American. I was born, you know, in the U.S. of A. And I spent much of my early life there, as you can probably gather from my accent. So, I mean, I'm not talking about this from some outside position, but as a citizen of both these places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and here, I mean, they make it pretty clear whenever they talk about Yemen at all that this is basically a sop to the Saudis for not opposing the nuclear deal too strongly, basically.
But
so go ahead.
I believe it goes well beyond that, okay? I actually believe it's also about, it's not, that may be the justification, okay? But I don't believe that this level of planning and silence actually is just a sop. I believe that our governments are heavily involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just don't understand. I guess I don't understand why they wouldn't just deal with the Houthis. The Houthis don't seem like you couldn't just negotiate with them if it's oil they want or whatever it is they want.
No, of course. Of course. I mean, their political wing is highly political. It's right. It negotiates politically. They've signed on to most of the points of the UN resolution to do 1-6. You know, they're not Al-Qaeda or Daesh. And in fact, it is our side backing the Saudis, who mm-hmm. brought them first into Mukallah and who patronized those forms of ideology and that kind of militia group, whether it's in Syria or Yemen. There's something bigger, right? I mean, there's no earthly reason not to negotiate and to go back to through Oman. Poor Oman, they actually hit the house of the ambassador in Sana'a the other day. And Oman described the coalition attacks on Yemen as a threat to regional peace. And then they said, oh, no, we didn't do it. The Houthis did it, as usual. Well, of course they did it.
Right.
So Oman stayed out, and Oman has been a neutral element within this. And Oman is where all of the negotiations have been being conducted. Time and again, the Saudis, backed by their partners, will not go to negotiate.
All right. Just one final note. I would love to read what you've written before about the international community destroying Yemeni agriculture and forcing them to be so dependent on imports in the first place. I'm shocked but not surprised to hear that from you. I'd love to read up on that, and maybe we could talk about that at some point in the future. But I've kept you way over time here, but I'm so appreciative of your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I hope I stayed on topic, and I'll send you the two links.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Martha.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
Great. Take care.
Okay, everybody. That is Martha Mundy. She is Professor Emeritus in Anthropology at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and she wrote this thing at Counterpunch that you got to read, Yemen as Laboratory. Why is the West so silent about this savage war? And really important stuff there. Please check it out. And so we're so far over time, it's already almost time for the next break. But I wanted to remind you again about Jason's coverage at antiwar.com. UN to let Saudis investigate themselves on Yemen war crimes. And then I thought I might play you this just because it's kind of funny by today's production standards.
In international waters in the Gulf of Tonkin, destroyers of the United States Navy are assigned routine patrols from time to time. Sunday, August the 2nd, 1964, the destroyer Maddox was on such a patrol. Shortly after noon, the calm of the day is broken as general quarters sound. In a deliberate and unprovoked action, three North Vietnam PT boats unleash a torpedo attack against the Maddox.
The destroyer was carrying out a mission of patrol in those waters, in international waters. When it was attacked, it...
Oh, man, it's not supposed to end there. Why is it in there? All right, anyway. Yeah, man. So listen, I got an admission for you, which is when I read this article, it was the first that I had ever learned of this Ansarala movement. I mean, I think the way she put it basically was when people say the Houthis, they mean the armed ones, the IRA, to Ansarala's Sinn Féin. In other words, call them on the telephone and talk. But nope. Just keep on bombing them. And yeah, the deafening silence on this issue in the major media and from most of the NGOs and all that. Just absolutely incredible. You know, I remember there was a guy, I don't remember who it was anymore. It's just a regular guy I know, you know? Not particularly dumb or particularly isolated, just a guy who said to me, "We had a war against Libya?" I didn't know that. And I said, "Yeah." And this was like in 2013, I guess he said that. And I said, "Yeah, in 2011. You don't remember that? For 9 months straight, they bombed Libya, man." Oh, I didn't know that. Well, man, if the average guy, maybe my one anecdote ain't good enough. Maybe we ought to run a poll with a scientific sample size. But I gotta wonder, man, how many Americans have any idea that Saudi is bombing Yemen right now, that innocent people are dying, and that Obama and the empire are in on it? Are behind it all. You know, Obama can call the Pentagon and say, stop helping the Saudis bomb Yemen immediately or the day after tomorrow or whatever he wants, and they have to do what he says. That's it. But their orders are, bomb the hell out of Yemen. And as she put it, I think quite aptly, it's a fantasy that everything is just going to work out the way they want. Look at how well it's working out now. We're at 6 months of this. And now the Cantina song is playing. Kind of broke my concentration. Later on, people listening to the archive of this without the bumper music are going to say, huh? What's he talking about, man? I'm Scott Horton. This is my ridiculous show. I'll be back in a minute here. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's Friday, right? Unless I screwed up, man. No, cool. It's Friday, man. All right. Well, there's something good. All right. So, Russia in Syria. Bear with me for a second. This might sound crazy for a second, and I'm pretty sure I'm wrong. But let me try this one out on you. Is it possible that Obama's half-assed Bay of Pigs over the long-term style intervention in Syria over the last 4 years is simply him playing chess like Zbigniew Brzezinski? Like Zbigniew Brzezinski claimed after the fact he did on purpose. And create a situation to lure the Russians in to give them their own Vietnam against the Mujahideen. In other words, Bush Jr. was dumb as a communist and fell for it. Is it possible that Obama, in backing the Mujahideen against Assad this whole time, but never enough to really overthrow him, was simply a plan to trick the Russians and lure them into doing the same damn thing that they did to themselves in the 1980s in Afghanistan? Bleed them to bankruptcy. Bog them down in a no-win fight. In fact, here, see, I got the quote. Oops. Oh, come on, mouse, you stupid mouse. Get back where I want you. What happened? I think my battery's dying. My mouse is stuck on the wrong screen. Screwing up my soundbite, man, when I had it all ready and everything.
You started this damn war. Now you have to deal with it.
And we will. It is just a matter of time before we achieve a complete victory.
You know there won't be a victory. Every day your war machines lose ground to a bunch of poorly armed, poorly equipped freedom fighters. The fact is that you underestimated your competition. If you'd studied your history, you'd know that these people have never given up to anyone. They'd rather die than be slaves to an invading army. You can't defeat a people like that. We tried. We already had our Vietnam. Now you're going to have yours.
So that's from Rambo 3, right? Recognize John Trotman? I'm Trotman. He got captured by the KGB in Afghanistan. You think you can win a fight against these guys? Man, the Pashtuns, they are born to kill. Really? They love it. And they're going to kill you. And what's Vietnam? Especially for you young kids. What does it mean to have a Vietnam? It means a gigantic, couldn't possibly win quagmire of death and destruction and bankruptcy and destabilization of your home country and the region where you're screwing around. A big, gigantic, stupid mistake. Being the nicest way to phrase it. Something really, really stupid to do that you shouldn't have done that you thought was smart because you're stupid. No offense to the Vietnamese. I know it's the name of your country, but I'm just saying, when used in that context, what it means is a war that you shouldn't fight because it does no good and only harm. So, what was the strategy? To lure the Russians in and replicate our defeat in Vietnam on their part in Afghanistan. Which is then, you know, the Mujahideen learned the lesson from that. If you want to kill an empire, lure them into a no-win war in Afghanistan. Which is exactly what they did to us. And then here we are, giving ourselves our own Vietnam again. Even then, that's when that's what we already called it 20 years before. A quicksand trap. But now maybe this is all Obama's doing. I hate to be too conspiratorial about it or whatever, but you know, and Eric Margulies, by the way, says that Zbigniew Brzezinski's a liar. But Zbigniew Brzezinski claims that it was his policy to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan before the Soviets ever invaded. In, you know, stir up the Muslims, as he put it, in order to provoke the Soviets to invade to back up their communist sock puppet dictatorship. And then the doubling and tripling down of the policy of the Reagan years. And all of that. So, you know, as the Russians embark on what is sure to be a horrific bloodbath, I mean, they're only just getting started there. You know, it'll be interesting to see. To me, just as, I mean, it's not the most important point or whatever. It's just a curiosity to me. I know it's hard to attribute deliberate, you know, methodical motives to the idiots that run American foreign policy. I mean, they really are so stupid. For all our talk about the Yanan plan and the clean break and all of that, nothing in the clean break said turn 2/3 of Iraq over to Iran. It was supposed to be easy. They're supposed to get a Hashemite king and a bunch of compliant Shia who basically bow down to pray on Friday and then just stay bowed down all year round for their new glorious king. And just think back, if you were old enough to really remember how it was in 2002, just how certain they were, you know? Just, I guess, with everybody, with everything, right? Their level of certainty is exactly proportionate to how wrong they are about whatever it is. And now, anyway, I don't know. It's funny, though, I got accused, all libertarians stand accused now, apparently, of being pro-Russia. Since we've been against American regime change plans in Syria for going on 2 decades straight now, since the clean break was ever published. Certainly since the Bush years and the popularization of the neocons and the new American century and what they're really all about, which is Likud party policy in Israel, basically. Since we're against the U.S. backing Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, the U.S. and its allies backing Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and the FSA, which are also suicide bombers and prisoner beheaders this whole time, then that means somehow that equates to being pro-Russia, since Russia also is against America backing Al-Qaeda in Syria to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. See how that works? Don't you feel like you're guilty of treason now for not supporting Al-Qaeda? Anyway, here's the other thing that we know about air wars, whether they're American and Russian ones. They don't work. And so I guess it's the real question is whether the Russians are going to, you know, fall for it like they did in the past and put a ground army in there. It might take a ground army to defeat America's Al-Qaeda legions. Guess we'll see. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, kiddos, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Joined again on the phone by John Pfeffer. He is from Foreign Policy in Focus. And he wrote this very important piece, FPIF.org. It'll be running on antiwar.com over the weekend here. The Middle East's New Nakba. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, John?
Good, good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Very, very happy to have you back on. Really great piece that you did here. I like how you're so good on history that you can make all the proper comparisons and parallels and draw all the right lessons and stuff. It's the difference between data and knowledge going on here. So I like that. The Middle East new Nakba. Well, first of all, what's a Nakba?
Nakba is a catastrophe, and it refers to the displacement of millions of Palestinians in 1948 when Israel was created. And obviously for Israelis, 1948 is a date to be celebrated, creation of Israel. But for Palestinians, it's a tragedy. And many ended up in refugee camps far from their original villages. Many would like to return to the villages that they left more than 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so you bring up India and Pakistan and the split after the British left, or the split that the British made as they were leaving, I guess, however you want to characterize that, the breakup of the Balkans and, you know, what it means when people are stuck on the so-called wrong side of the ethnic and religious lines and the different kinds of ethnic cleansing. So what's the point of bringing up those examples in context of what's happening in the Middle East now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a belief somehow that, you know, if people end up in the right place, in other words, with their religious or ethnic brothers and sisters, then suddenly life will be fine. That the problem lies in the mixture of people and the heterogeneity of countries that causes conflict. And what people often forget in their attempts to create more homogeneous nation states is the tremendous tragedy, not only of the partition itself. And I bring up India, Pakistan, Greece, and Turkey because of the huge number of people who died during these ethnic cleansing campaigns, but the tragedy of the end of these multicultural societies. Now, of course, there's still Muslims in India and there's still some Hindus in Pakistan, but previously, these were much richer multicultural countries, and the partitions, in fact, didn't end the kind of the conflicts between peoples. In many cases, it just pushed these conflicts up to international rather than internal conflicts. We're facing something very similar in the Middle East today. We're seeing millions and millions of people being expelled from Syria, leaving either voluntarily because of the horrific civil war that's taking place, or actually being expelled by, in many cases, the Islamic State because they're the wrong religion, or they might even be the right religion, but they don't practice it the way the Islamic State would like them to practice it. In other words, the same kind of ethnic cleansing campaign is sweeping through the Middle East, again, to toward a goal, ultimately, of creating homogeneous states. But in fact, all this is doing is creating tremendous misery and also pushing these conflicts to a different level.
Yeah. Well, and of course, we've seen really since the invasion in 03, where the parties, I'm not trying to accuse the entire Shiite civilian population of Iraq or anything like that, but the parties with the power, and especially the ones chosen by Bush to accentuate the power of, like the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party, Skiri's Badr Brigade Army, they were on a policy from really the very beginning after the war of basically conscripting the U.S. Army and Marine Corps in their service to help kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. And they kind of have been, you know, it's kind of waxed and waned just how hard they were pushing at any given time. And I guess they sort of backed off for a little while. But now it looks like, you know, like in the Sunni neighborhoods in the southwest of Baghdad and other places in, was it Nasiriyah province, is kind of between Baghdad and Kurdistan, but a little bit to the east there, where there were Sunnis, the Shiite militias are now finishing kicking them out and into Islamic State territory. So this is, you know, something that we should never let it go unmentioned, no matter how obvious it should be to people, that George W. Bush kicked this all off with his invasion from Kuwait in 2003.
Absolutely. And you're right. First, in terms of what the Shiite militias are doing in Iraq, they're basically using the Islamic State as an excuse to go after any and all Sunnis that they wanted to kick out of territories and claim those territories for themselves, a process of ethnic cleansing on the ground, mirrored, of course, by what the Islamic State is doing. And number two, you're absolutely correct that, you know, this process, this kind of larger decomposition of multi-ethnic states in the region was kicked off by the invasions of the invasion of Iraq by the Bush administration and the earlier conflict, the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein. Yeah. The Bush administration, you know, had this conception that it could recreate the Middle East according to the U.S. template, and that would be to create these new states essentially that would be allies to the United States, much as, say, Saudi Arabia or Israel is an ally of the United States. But of course, they didn't really think through this very carefully because they weren't really thinking so much in terms of what would happen to the people on the ground. They were only thinking in terms of very narrow policy goals, i.e. getting rid of Saddam Hussein or securing U.S. access to natural resources. They didn't realize that, of course, what they were doing was going to trigger an enormous kind of Nakba, an enormous catastrophe in the region. Subsequently, of course, the United States aligned itself with one faction or another in order to continue to achieve these narrow goals, mm-hmm. and only further kind of accentuated the kind of decentralization process, further accentuated the ethnic cleansing that took place, and of course, continued, you know, these conflicts that have claimed huge numbers of lives, you know, hundreds of thousands, you know, upwards of half a million in Iraq, or around a third of a million in Syria. And of course, the expulsion of enormous numbers of people. We're talking about half the population of Syria is currently displaced. About 4 million people have left the country. This is a catastrophe of huge dimensions.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you look back to it, say 2003 and 4, we can't leave now. The violence will get worse. And so we have to stay in order to prevent the thing. When in fact, all the incentive that the Shia majority could have possibly had to negotiate with the Sunni minority, we were relieving them of those pressures by allowing them to use our Army and Marine Corps to accomplish their goals. And now maybe there would have been a massive civil war, which I guess the Shia would have been bound to win eventually anyway, even if we had left. But if the Shiite parties had ever had any incentive to hold Iraq together and negotiate with the Sunni, it would have been if the Americans had left, not staying there and basically acting as, you know, Sadr and al-Hakim's special forces brigades.
Yeah. I mean, in Korea, you know, the divided Korean peninsula, people would often tell me that U.S. military presence was like a knife stuck into the peninsula. And that they were worried that if they took the knife out, the peninsula would bleed to death. And so that was a justification for the continued presence of the U.S. military in the Korean Peninsula. But what they didn't realize, of course, that the knife was not just in place, that the knife was actually twisting as well. And this clearly the case in the Middle East as well. The presence of the U.S. military was no longer simply holding internal organs in place and preventing a bleed out. It was actually continuing to do damage. Yeah. And
all right, wait, stop right there, John. We got to stop. It's John Pfeffer, everybody, from FPIF, Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for all the stuff. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Although, I warn you, I might be mean to you. I'm kind of mean on there. I'm talking with John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org, and antiwar.com, or original.antiwar.com/Pfeffer. This one will be running over the weekend, the Middle East's new Nakba. The complete upturning of the Middle East and the creation of this massive sectarian war, if you want to call it that, a regional war between the Saudis and the Iranians, with America on our enemy's side as the Saudis use Al-Qaeda shock troops to get their dirty work done in Iraq and Syria, and America is trying to stand in the way of all those who would fight our enemies for us and help our enemies win instead. And this has helped. Well, you know, they're redirecting from back when they accidentally took Iran's side in Iraq War II, which they didn't mean to do. So now they're trying to fix that by making everything 10 times worse. And, you know, honestly, John, when I heard the recent refugee numbers, I didn't believe them because I was going, wait a minute, wait. How can it possibly add up? They're saying, I'm sorry, worldwide, I think they were saying 60 million or something like that, or 50 million people or something. And I went adding it up and got some help from Dan Sanchez. And then, yeah, no, that really panned out. And about what, somewhere approximately 10 million of these are from America's wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, maybe more than that.
That's correct. It's just a little under 60 million. And this is the largest since World War II. It is it's unbelievable, frankly, the numbers. Afghanistan was the leading kind of source of refugees up until Syria overtook it. And it's the last year or two, Syrian war has really pushed millions of people out of the country. And, you know, it only registered on the radar of the world community when these folks started showing up in Europe. Because, of course, you know, there were almost 2 million Syrians in Turkey. There are a million or so in Lebanon and Jordan in refugee camps that in those latter two countries that no longer have sufficient funds to cover their food and basic health services. It's a unbelievable slow motion tragedy taking place in those refugee camps because the international community has not put sufficient funds toward that. But it only became an issue when these folks decided that it was impossible to live in Jordan and Lebanon and continued to in an attempt to get into Europe, either by boat across the Mediterranean or the land route through Turkey up through the Balkans. And now, of course, we're looking at more than 1 million people flooding into Europe. And suddenly this has become an issue. And, you know, it's only when people show up at the door of the rich countries that the rich countries really take notice.
Yeah. Well, and even then they don't. They just keep on bombing Yemen and keep on bombing Iraq. And even when the Russians finally call their bluff, they want to keep on supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria. And they must be crazy.
Yeah, it's I mean, I think the Europeans, well, some of the Europeans have taken a step back to examine the kind of effect of these aerial attacks in Syria and Iraq on the not only the flow of refugees, but on the kind of centrifugal violence that is spinning these countries apart, namely Iraq and Syria. The United States, well, the United States hasn't really taken a step back. I mean, of course, at the UN, President Obama did say, and this is good, that, you know, diplomacy is really the only answer here, that military solution is not the solution. But that doesn't really register so much in terms of U.S. policy. We continue to conduct an enormous number of aerial sorties, up around 7,000. And, you know, Russia, too, has said that there should be a political solution, but that hasn't prevented Russia from entering the fray as well. They conducted their first aerial attacks this last week. So, unfortunately, you know, the principal countries, United States, Russia, and the European Union, have not sat down to push for a political solution. I think Iran has consistently pushed for a political solution, but it's been frozen out of these discussions for the most part. So it's finally, I think, time for all of these concerned countries to say, hey, look, it's obvious what the effects are of this strategy. They've failed these aerial attacks. We have to obviously push for a political solution.
Okay, now this is crazy, but I'm going to ask you what you think about it, and I'm sure you'll say, no, that's crazy. But Eric Margolis says that he's a damn liar and he's just trying to take extra credit for himself, and it's not true. But and Eric Margolis might well know that for a fact. Zbigniew Brzezinski claims that he had Jimmy Carter start backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan before the Russians invaded in order to provoke them into invading, that it was his brilliant idea all along, not just he took advantage of their invasion, but that he helped to provoke it to give them their own Vietnam, which, of course, you and I probably have laughed over the years about. Here's America giving ourselves our own Vietnam in Afghanistan again, with all the harm that comes from doing that to yourself, that kind of thing. But so it's not that difficult to discern. And for all the talk about how smart our brilliant commander-in-chief is with his third-dimensional chess and this, that, and the other thing, somewhat devotee of Zbigniew Brzezinski, is it possible that Obama's half-assed, failed, as you called it, campaign of backing the Mujahideen against Assad for the last 4 years has actually been the exact same program again, trying to lure the Russians into invading and bogging themselves down against the Mujahideen, just like in the 1980s, and that it's all, this is Putin basically falling for the same scam again?
Well, it's an interesting idea, but no. I mean, I think the one of the primary goals of the Obama administration has been to contain Russia and to push it as far out of the Middle East as possible, to deny it its one base in Syria, TARDIS, to essentially freeze it out of any kind of geopolitical role. It would prefer it not to be involved even in the near abroad. In other words, the former members of the Soviet Union, the republics, but it obviously has been unable to do that. I do, however, think, and this is an argument I made, you know, back in 2002, that Osama bin Laden had very much this strategy on his mind, very much the Zbigniew Brzezinski strategy,
right,
of luring the United States into conflicts in the Middle East and Afghanistan, that it was only when the United States would be battling far from its strength and battling against non-state actors for the most part, that it would potentially face the same kind of crisis that the Soviet Union faced in Afghanistan. And of course, Osama bin Laden knew very well what happened to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and so he didn't have a lot of models from which to choose. And I do think that motivated him, and that was the kind of strategy lurking behind his attacks on U.S. targets.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. He said it from 1996 on, exactly what he was up to. No question there. But so, I mean, it seems like Brzezinski's still around, and they must have learned the lesson that actually the failure of containment after Vietnam, when the American people didn't want to contain the Soviet Union anymore, and it expanded its commitments into Latin America, Africa, and Afghanistan especially, that's what finally broke the Soviet Union. So I totally would, I'm just pretending that Brzezinski's smart for just a second and that he's talking with Obama and that he's trying to even think in terms of a couple of moves ahead on the chessboard here. And hell yeah, they want to keep him out of Ukraine. They want Ukraine and NATO if they can because they're that loony. But maybe if we could squeeze him here and squeeze him here, but push him into a no-win quagmire, Osama bin Laden, Zbigniew Brzezinski's style plot to bog them down fighting the Mujahideen in Syria, that would be a perfect way to finally, you know, bankrupt the Kremlin government and get their regime change in Russia, which is what they're really all about here, right?
Well, you know, if you wanted to be Brzezinski about all this, and I would have to say that Brzezinski, for all of the craziness that he promoted during the 1970s and 1980s, in comparison to the neocons, he's proven, you know, quite a realist, you know, and therefore.
Well, he's been good on Iran. I mean, exactly. That's for sure. There's definitely a line between his view and theirs on Iran, but on who controls the world island and all of that, I think.
Yeah. Well,
he's pretty much in the lead.
Right. From that point of view, I mean, really, the key here, if you wanted to pin down Russia, it would not so much be to bring them into Syria, but to really accelerate and encourage the centrifugal trends within Russia itself. I mean, we're looking at North Caucasus, Dagestan, areas that Russia has had great difficulty controlling. And, you know, if you wanted to be Zbigniew about this, you know, you wouldn't really push so much for the Syria scenario. You would look for encouraging the Islamic State affiliates in that area, as well as the Chechens, to basically push against federal control in Moscow. Mm-hmm. I mean, that hits much harder at Putin and at the Russian kind of project than anything that would take place in Syria.
Yeah. Although, I mean, they're just getting started, right? So, and they're in a real tough spot. I mean, even if America and the allies backed off supporting the Mujahideen now, which I don't think is really likely, they're probably more likely to double down, the Saudis and Turks, especially for supporting these guys. It doesn't seem, you know, I'm sure the Russian Petraeus is asking, tell me how this ends now that they're there and have this task of supporting, you know, Hezbollah and what's left of the Syrian army against these. I mean, they are just Al-Qaeda loonies with suicide bombers and AKs, but there are apparently legions of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're still around a fighting strength of 20 to 30,000. But, you know, I do think that Putin is really looking to elevate his kind of geopolitical stature in this. And, you know, no one's going to take him seriously if he's just going to be saying, look, we're friends of Bashar al-Assad. People will take him seriously when they're actually launching airstrikes. And I think that ultimately is what Putin wants. He wants a place at the table. He wants to be able to help determine whatever outcome is around the corner in Syria. I don't see him really committing more troops. And there's only a small contingent of Russians there. There's very little popularity inside Russia for the presence of Russian troops in Syria. I think Putin is very, very smart about the fragility not only of Russian position in Syria, but even to a certain extent, the fragility of his own political support within Russia. I don't think he wants to do anything that could jeopardize that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess there actually has been in the last week, and I'm sorry I'm keeping you over time here. Let me just ask you this one more thing here. Kerry and Obama and a couple of others have started using language like, yeah, well, maybe Assad could go at the end of the negotiations instead of the beginning and that kind of thing. Are those little trial balloons, is that just propaganda, or that's actually a signal that they've realized they have to back down from this policy, that they cannot debothify this government and abolish this army without turning Damascus over to Al-Qaeda? At best, ISIS, you know, supposedly even worse than that.
Oh, absolutely. I think there is a dose of realism within the State Department and within the Pentagon as well about the inability of the United States to determine the outcome on the ground militarily. They dug themselves into a difficult position by insisting that Assad had to leave, and they're kind of walking their way back from that position. The real question is not so much, you know, what kind of political solution. Because it's too premature to talk about that. But really, the question is, who will sit down at the table to talk about it? And that, I think, they're still kind of working out. And, you know, I think Iran has to play a major role here. And that's something that hitherto the Obama administration has been very uncomfortable with. And it knows that it's going to get serious congressional pushback from such a proposal. But ultimately, Iran has to be at the table, and that is really the bigger question than the disposition of Assad when he goes, if he goes, etc.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, man, I really appreciate you coming back on the show, John. It's
been a
great
pleasure. Thank you.
All right, so that is the great John Pfeffer. He's at Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org, and you can also find him at original.antiwar.com/Pfeffer. And over this weekend, we'll be running the Middle East's new Nakba. And we're way over time for the day. See y'all next week. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audio book of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com.